Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View radio show. Also joining me is my co-host, Luis Mejia from Murdoch Capital Partners. Our podcast archives are available on iTunes, Zoom, and also available on our website, which is www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @CleanEnergyView, or simply call into the show at area code 917-932-1068. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@CleanEnergyView.com. Today, we're going to be talking about how economically viable is natural gas. According to the EPA, natural gas is defined as a fossil fuel formed when layers of buried plants and animals are exposed to intense heat and pressure over thousands of years. The energy that the plants and animals originally obtained from the sun is stored in the form of carbon and natural gas. Natural gas is combusted to generate electricity, enabling the stored energy to be transformed into usable power. Natural gas is a non-renewable resource because it cannot be replenished on a human time frame. The natural gas power production process begins with the extraction of natural gas, continues with its treatment and transport to the power plants, and ends with its combustion in boilers and turbines to generate electricity. As most of you know, natural gas is used to generate electricity, serves as an alternative to gasoline, can be used to generate hydrogen, and helps create fertilizer. It has a cost advantage over other forms of energy, such as solar, wind, and geothermal. However, there's a huge debate as to whether or not natural gas makes sense because of the pros and cons with this form of energy, such as the environmental impact, the current return on the investment, and the impact on the face of energy. So on today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the show energy expert Tom Drolet. Mr. Drolet worked in the energy industry and technology innovation industries for over 42 years. He brought a wealth of experience at the senior management level to the electrical utility industry at Ontario Hydro, the fourth largest electrical utility in the world, and also American Electric Power and DTE Energy. And Mr. Drolet has spoken at over 175 major conferences on issues in energy and the effects of new technologies on the economies of the Western world. So I would like to first welcome to the show my co-host, Luis Mejia from Murdoch Capital Partners. Good afternoon, Luis.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you. And our very special guest, Mr. Tom Drolet. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, June. Good to be back.
Tom, can you please talk about your experience with natural gas? Let's start off by talking about where we're actually at with natural gas in North America.
Okay, I'll try and be succinct here, June. There's so much to talk about, of course, in this area, and it's a very brave topic for you, by the way. Congratulations for having it on your show. And it's almost wise that I'm here on the telephone rather than in person with folks. I may get pummeled with tomatoes. I'm just kidding. Worldwide, first of all, and I'll get to the States real quick, just to remind everybody, you know, the world use of fuel sources is very variable. The number one still worldwide fuel is oil. I know we talk a lot about how it's going down, but it's still 33% of all the fuel used in the world comes from oil on an energy basis. 30% from coal. 23% from natural gas. 5.5% from nuclear, and 6% from hydroelectric and renewables, about 1.32%. Those are up-to-date, real values. Here in the States, it varies quite a bit from that, and I'll focus on natural gas. the natural gas is now up to 32% compared to that worldwide figure I just gave you of 23%. Coal is around about 34%. Oil is down at about 26%. Nuclear is way up there as a percentage of operating electrical output at 20%. Hydroelectric's somewhat lower in the U.S. We don't have a lot of waterfall power. And renewables is up there around 2% these days. So natural gas is hovering in around 32% of the energy used in the U.S. today for transportation, for electricity, and all the other uses that it has in manufacturing of chemicals and so forth.
Now, what are the current benefits to utilizing natural gas, especially here in North America?
Well, the benefits come right down to the basic uses. Let's deal, first of all, with the chemical industry, which I include not just drugs and polymers, but also fertilizers and so forth. It's a key component to our daily lives in use of fertilizers for improvements in soil. Of course, that's countered against the organic farming group. But anyway, it's used big time in fertilizers. In fact, is the core component of making fertilizers besides the potash and the phosphorus that goes into fertilizers itself. In the manufacture of polymers, which end up mostly in plastic-related materials we use in our everyday life, natural gas, again, is the key component, commodity used in that process, and derivatives of natural gas like ethylene and so forth. And finally, we have electricity that I'm most conversant with myself, and that is that 32-odd percent that's used for generating electricity these days. It's increasing dramatically. That figure only 2 years ago was 24%. In the U.S. of A, and is now 32%. So the ramp-up in the use of natural gas for electricity generation is dramatic. I can give you just one example. Georgia Power, here in the southeast of the U.S., in the rough area where I am in Florida, they have gone from generating, I believe it was 46% with coal, and today they're down at 34% generation of electricity with coal, and all of the difference has gone to natural gas. So there's a dramatic uptick in the use of natural gas, and obviously it's price-driven.
When it comes to the actual return on the investment right now on natural gas, what are your opinions about that?
Well, let me go back and say the point that you're raising is a really interesting one from a business aspect. My bottom line statement would be today, in the generation of natural gas through fracking techniques that I know we're going to get into big time, is a net negative balance. It's negative. But let me try and get to the core of why that is so. You know, 10 years ago, a mere 10 years ago, we in the industry that were using natural gas for generating electricity were deathly afraid of the fact that conventional means, vertical means of drilling for natural gas in shallow and deep wells, be it off the Gulf Coast or on land in Texas and so forth, there is dramatically diminishing returns of natural gas. We were expecting that we would ramp up from, say, 52 billion cubic feet a day in use to perhaps 60 by today, and yet all of the projections were going down. There were diminishing returns, and then along came this technical revolution, and I have to use the word revolution, not an evolution, in this fracking technique with horizontal drilling in the dominant seams in the earth where the natural gas is to extract it. So it was a combination of horizontal drilling technology and the fracking, or the opening up of pores in the rock to allow the natural gas out, that came out of almost nowhere. And today we have a situation where if 10 years ago somebody had told me we had natural gas in oversupply, I would have said, you're crazy. But we've got it. And that was because of this technical revolution. So the bottom line is that the drilling costs of fracking and horizontal drilling combination is on average somewhere between $6 to $8 and sometimes even $10 million per bore well. That's a lot of money. Even though we're getting lots and lots of natural gas out, the net cost on average, and this is a very difficult number but is key to our discussion today, on average, with all of the fields, be it the Haynesville or the Utica or the various shale gas domains that we have all over the U.S., in order to get a positive return, you need somewhere around $4 to $4.5 per million cubic feet of natural gas obtained. Whereas today's price, I think I saw it this morning at about $2.95.
Luis, were you going to comment
Tom,
about
this? Yeah, Tom, this is a question that I think I've asked you this before. So what is really directly impacting that? I mean, we should be having some really inexpensive, you know, source of clean fuel. And instead, we still have a lot of, you know, oil and gas usage, a lot of coal. And frankly, I mean, oil and gas and coal, everything is priced pretty much globally, even though gas is as well. Why is it that we don't have such a consistency in the pricing, or for that matter, a predictability in the pricing as we do with some of the other fossil fuels?
Good question. If I take you back for just a moment to oil, oil has a worldwide price. Today, I didn't look at it, but let's say it's somewhere, if you look at the WTI price in the States, I think around $91, $92 a barrel. And if you go off the Brent or the European price, more or less the way we price our gasoline off that these days, I think it's around $110 a barrel. It's a worldwide price. It can be looked up, and you know exactly what, you know, if you were an ExxonMobil, what you're going to get per barrel. In natural gas, because it's a gas, and because, therefore, it has extremely high volume, it's very much an islanded commodity. And what I mean by that is it has a price here in the U.S. that is unique to the U.S. because it's so difficult to transport around the world to other users. Now, I'll modify that in a moment when I get into a bit on LNG, but that's the reality. And because of oversupply, because of this technical revolution in horizontal drilling and fracking, that price today is, I think it was $2.95, I was saying, whereas we need $4 to $4.5 for it to be profitable. Whereas in Japan, here's an up-to-date price just to floor you, the price of natural gas landed through LNG, liquefied natural gas, coming from either Indonesia or Australia or the Middle East from the UAE. That's landing in Tokyo Bay at $21 a million cubic feet. You know, what's that? Almost nine times our price, because it has such a large component of having to bring it to a liquid through cryogenic means, transporting it thousands of miles in boats, then regasifying it on shore, piping it to the use. It's not a worldwide price.
Go ahead, boys.
In speaking of that, I think you're going to address the LNG issues and how that's going to be moving forward. I just don't see, Tom, how it will become a worldwide price until basically LNG becomes a very significant part of the process in
right.
terms of standardizing and delivering and delivery costs. I mean, I don't see how you're going to get to that until, as I said before, until you have a significant increase in the use of global use of gas. And of course, countries like Japan that have to import everything probably will be the uptick in the price rather than the affecting the blended price, which would obviously would affect the prices where the gas is much cheaper.
Right. Well, you bring up a couple of points. First of all, I've got to quickly add to the conversation here that even though we're finding so much shale gas here in the U.S., they're finding it all over the world. There are large pockets in Poland, in France, in the U.K., in parts of southeast Germany, into the Czech Republic and so forth. Italy even has lots. There's buckets being found in North Africa in the traditional conventional natural gas regimes. They're starting to do fracking and horizontal drilling there. I'm just painting a picture that shale gas revolution is occurring everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you believe, therefore, as I do, based on the evidence being presented by the people drilling, that natural gas will be a very abundant worldwide source, there still will be areas that don't have it. And a good example is the one you bring up, Luis, Japan. But there's others like South Korea and so forth. So we'll be building a lot of LNG plants, by the way, extremely expensive things.
Oh, yeah.
Or the compression where you find it in Indonesia, Australia, or the Middle East, and even the south coast, or pardon me, the west coast and south coast of the U.S. where there are LNG plants today. Those installations are $1 billion or $2. And then you get the decompression stages at the receiving end. They're $500 million to $1 billion. This is big bucks. And when that gets built out, I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime. I do think that we'll see, in other words, 20, 30 years of building these LNG plants. That's the day, two or three decades from now, when I see a worldwide price for natural gas emerging.
Now, let me ask you a question. I'm not obviously the expert from Wall Street that Luis is, not even close to it, but just out of curiosity, the fact that the prices keep fluctuating, doesn't that have a negative impact on the stock of a company?
Oh, sure it does.
Sure.
It really does, eh, Luis? You look at Chesapeake Energy. I know it had some chairman difficulties or people difficulties recently. But if you look at the price that's been as low as, I think I saw it at $1.87 or so, a million BTUs. In other words, more than a dollar lower about a month or two ago. And then it got up to about $3.30 or so 2 weeks ago. And now it's back down around $2.95. This certainly drives these companies crazy because it's mostly driven by the vagaries of weather. You get a real warm spell like we had a couple of weeks ago in the Midwest and the Northeast, and I guess it's still warm up there where you are, June and Luis. The price will tend to stay up, but we're starting to approach, for example, what's called in the business the shoulder season, where it goes down off the heights of the hot summer weather-driven commodity use to a much lower level before it ramps up in the winter because of cold temperatures. And we could very possibly get back down to the 180, a million BTU regime, that really gives great difficulty for these drilling companies to know when to actually spend those very big bucks. Remember I was mentioning $6, $8, $10 billion a well.
Mm-hmm.
And then because there's no use and there's no storage capability, we only have the capability in the U.S. to store approximately 32 to 34 trillion cubic feet in big salt domes. Mostly are in the Louisiana, New Orleans, and Gulf Shore areas. That capacity, I think we're already, even with summer use, somewhere around 82-84% capacity. Won't take long in the shoulder season to fill it up. And then these drilling companies will be probably still drilling, but capping the wells and waiting for the use to be driven up by cold weather.
It seems to be a resource that is not necessarily very stable as far as the fact that it fluctuates so much. So having said that, can we talk about the actual technology? What are some of the hurdles with the existing technology that they're using for hydrofracking?
Certainly. Well, basically, hydrofracking involves the following. It involves the carrier is water. So it requires copious quantities of water. Mm-hmm. And I'm not up in my head on the numbers. I apologize for that. But let's take a round number, I don't think I'm too far off, of 1 million gallons of water to frack a well. In that water, you need something that will keep the pores open when you hydropressure the water in the borehole and keep those pores open, because what you're really doing is, I'll use the word bang, you're pressurizing the water to fracture the rock, and then the rock has to have those pores you've created stay open. So they use materials, some very benign like sand, and some chemicals, which assist in making the sand stick in the pores to keep them open afterwards. Some of those chemicals they've used have been found to be toxic, and regulators are starting to pound the heck out of the industry to make sure that not only do they declare what chemicals are being used, but also, of course, to control toxicity levels and so forth. So that's how it's done. Basically, the drill bit goes down vertically, approximately, on average, a mile to a mile and a half to 2 miles, depending on the shale gas regime you're in, be it in the northeast of the U.S. or in, say, the Louisiana region, where they tend to be deeper than up in the northeast. You then turn the bit through shims gradually over perhaps anywhere from 40 to 80 meters of travel vertically. You turn it horizontally, gradually shimming the bit to drill into the seam you want to get into. And then that seam could be up to half a mile to three-quarters of a mile long. And then you get the drill bit and you bring it back out and you attach instead a device that allows the pressure of the water plus the sand and chemical mix to go blow through holes, if you will, in a sort of a cylinder. And that's what does the actual fracking. And you go along that horizontal travel, say every 20, 30 meters, stop it, push it, in other words, pressurize it, do the fracking or the blowing operation, get the sand in there, go along another 30 meters, do it again, for a mile, mile and a half. Yeah, it can be quite a long and laborious process, and you do that in every horizontal leg. And there may be four horizontal legs coming off of one vertical bore. So that's roughly how the process happens.
Now, considering the fact that, as you mentioned, they are starting to really come down on the companies, and especially with the regulations and whatnot, doesn't that make it a more expensive process?
Yes, it does. There are, let's, for the listeners, and cover off the two main areas of contention. Area number one is, in some cases, they've seen leakage of gas from the well bore. Oh, I should have said before, pardon me. I didn't complete my story well, June and Luis, I apologize. Once you then do the fracking, you, of course, extract that bit back up to the ground, and out starts to come the gas. Okay. There could be, in the upper areas of the well bore, areas where the casing, which is what you put into the well bore to seal off the casing from the surrounding rock mass, or the from the rock mass, the well bore from the rock mass, this casing sometimes isn't put in properly or has leak points in it. Therefore, the gas as it comes up can, in some cases, has been seen to leak into the groundwater, which, of course, is very close to the surface of the earth. So we're not talking about leakage from way down below doing the harm. It's once it gets up into the groundwater area, say anywhere from 20 meters below the surface to 100 meters below, that's average groundwater in the U.S., then that leakage can get into groundwater, get into people's water supply, and we've seen cases of that. That's point number one. Point number two is all of the water I talked about, the million gallons a borehole, is put into storage ponds on the surface with the residual sand and residual chemicals that come back out. There can be leakage of toxic materials from that area. So regulators, and we've seen some of the moves in New York, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, down Louisiana, and so forth, they've come down very hard and very properly on the industry to shut off those two areas of potential pollution and harm, be it to the groundwater or through spillage of that water on the surface, that then gets back into the groundwater.
Now, moving forward, when it comes to investing in natural gas, and perhaps maybe this is a question for both you and Luis, you know, how sound of an investment is this if there are so many fluctuations, upcoming additional expenses that the companies will be forced to adhere to due to the new regulations and whatnot. You know, I just want some of your thoughts on this.
Well, I'll start it off, Luis, and just I'll cover off a business reality. There's a fact in the Wall Street investment business that when they look at an energy company, and I'll just take an example, Chesapeake Energy, happens to be on my mind today. They drill for oil and natural gas, predominantly natural gas, but for oil too. Take ExxonMobil as well. Won't pick on any particular company, but all of them have a requirement to have on their balance sheet something called a multi-year reserve capability. So one figure on the balance sheet is this thing called annual or years of reserves of fuel, be it oil or natural gas. When the investment community generally in Wall Street or anywhere in the world looks at a company like Exxon or like Chesapeake, they will quickly look at the years of reserves of fuel, be it oil or natural gas, they have on that balance sheet. If it falls, and I'm being general here in the number of years, if it falls below 10 years, they start to get worried, and they'll start to depress the share price because they get worried about replacing the reserves as they produce it for the market. If it's at 12 years, 13 years, for instance, as a reserve ratio, they'll say, hey, there's a good company, and the share price will go up. If it gets down to 9 or 8 years, they start to bite their fingernails and say, I wonder if that's a good company anymore. So where I'm going with this is to point out the following. Even though most companies drilling for and fracking for natural gas these days are doing it during a surplus period, as long as they drill for it and then cap that well, they can show those reserves on their balance sheet as years of reserve of fuel and keep that reserve ratio up so that Wall Street thinks better of them. So I just wanted to get that on the table, Luis.
Actually, I have a question that is more related to the technology side of the equation, because it directly impacts, obviously, exploration costs and just CapEx. And I know that 10, 15 years ago, one of our analysts said, you know, once we get the fracking to a point where it's the technology has made sufficient advances, then I think you're going to see that the companies are going to literally exponentially expand in terms of not only companies that are going to be out there doing this, but also internally. And I was going to ask you, what has been done recently, say in the last 4 or 5 years, because it seems like there has been some pretty, as you said, revolution. There's been some pretty major advancements in the fracking process. What is out there now or today that is going to take this to the next level, if there is a next level?
Okay. Well, great question. It brings out a difference between a decade ago and today in this revolution with fracking for natural gas. A decade ago, let me take you back, the normal sequence of events was that a junior or even a micro company would go and get a listing and would go out with a drill rig and would spend in the order of $500,000 to $1 million, drill a vertical hole, get a nice long-term flow of natural gas. Once it did that several times and was a success doing it, selling into a market that was at that time $5, $6, $7 a million BTUs, or pardon me, a million cubic feet, then these companies would then be bought by the intermediates, who would then be bought by the biggies, the Exxons and the Shells and so forth. That whole equation has changed. That whole business model of the juniors being eaten by the intermediates, being eaten by the biggies,
right,
is almost gone. It's gone. It's a big boy business these days. These wells now aren't $1 million or $500,000 anymore. They're $6, $8, $10 million a well. And in this really lousy market today we have, Luis, as you know, for funding juniors, the juniors just are having to fold their tent one by by tens. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult.
Oh, it's super difficult. So it's a whole business model change, and it's become, through high CapEx requirements, a big boy business. So, as I look ahead, it'll mostly be the majors that will dominate this business and expand it. That was the other part of your point, was how will it expand? It'll expand through the big guys. There won't be as many little guys involved, and it will get to be pretty much a dominated, say, in the U.S. by the top 10 or 12 or 15 companies. Even the intermediates will have to be big intermediates to stay in the game.
It's really interesting when you take a look at it from this perspective. Where do you see natural gas fitting in as far as enabling us to become independent from our existing oil dependency?
That's a great question. It's also fraught. It's fraught with difficulties going forward. Hi there, Tom Gillette. I lost
Hi,
you,
Tom.
June.
Sorry. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't know what went wrong there.
Hello.
Hi. That is probably good old technology here. But,
sure.
In any event.
Have we still got Luis there?
Yes.
Okay. I apologize, folks, for whatever happened there. But I was just going to say that I see a lot of optimism, maybe an overabundance of it these days, in the use of natural gas going forward. People are talking about converting all of our mobile transportation, our cars and trucks, fleets, to natural gas, compressed use, and so forth. All of that is possible and could happen. But let's have a look at reality for a moment. Gasoline in liquid form from liquid oil is still the most easily used of our energy commodities for transportation. What we have to do is massively build out the piping infrastructure to get natural gas first and foremost along the freeways, if we believe in our truck fleets having it, and then the cars that travel the freeways. And then just think of it, all that spaghetti of secondary roads and tertiary roads, if we really wanted natural gas to get to all of the fueling stations, which today, of course, have liquid gasoline there, then that would be a trillion-dollar exercise and would necessarily be done over decades. So people that are calling for natural gas to be the savior on the transportation side in the short term, I don't see it. And frankly, I don't really see it for our cars. It may come to pass for our truck fleets along the major freeways, as our friend from Texas keeps talking about. I'm sorry I've lost his name, Luis, the guy that talks his book all the time. It's just, I've lost
yeah.
it. He's on TV all the time anyway, talking about natural gas for truck fleets. I'm not trying to poo-poo it. I'm just saying it's a massive investment in our country's infrastructure to make that happen. Where I do see the use going up dramatically is in electricity generation. I see the inevitable gradual closing of this fleet of 1,200 or so coal-fired plants that we built, whose average age is 50, 60 years old. I see those gradually being shut down as EPA regulations make it uneconomical. And I see natural gas being used in new combined cycle gas turbine stations to replace that. That's where I see the major new use of natural gas.
Now, I guess my next question, this is directed towards Luis. Luis, what is your perspective as far as Wall Street's opinion looking at natural gas as a sound investment?
Well, again, I mean, as Tom has pointed out, I think it's if you're looking to the future, I think it's a great opportunity. The thing is, at the near term, it's not a globally priced. I don't think the industry sector on a global basis can compare to or is even in the same ballpark that other fossil fuels, the predominant ones being oil and coal. I think once, as Tom said, these majors really begin to expand that production and you can get some predictability globally, then I think you're going to see some of these companies really take off, not only in terms of stock price, but I also think in terms of generating revenues, and I think politically being much friendlier in the sense that they're going to have a very different footprint in terms of the environment, which is on everybody's mind these days. So,
just out of curiosity, Tom, the leases that you mentioned for the wells, who owns the majority of them?
Who owns the majority of what?
The leases?
Maybe Luis knows that better than I do, but basically most of the drilling that's being done is being done by these majors and intermediates. So it's the Chesapeakes and so forth that go into a property owner and do one-by-one deals with those property owners, get a lease on the use of that land and the surface drilling pads and so forth, and the storage ponds for the water for, I would assume, many years. And I've not personally seen any of those individual lease contracts between the drillers and the landowners, but I would assume they're multi-year mineral rights at depth and the ability to use various parts of their land for the drilling operation.
Yeah, Tom, I think most, they're pretty much done along the same lines as your standard either mining and or, I would more say, more like oil drilling.
Yeah, I guess so.
In terms of terms, I mean, some of the land obviously is not privately held; it's government, which is also an issue that is, you know, on everybody's, I guess, political mind these days, because we want to expand, or we should try to expand more drilling here in the United States in terms of gas and trying to bring cheaper fuels on as opposed to inhibiting or prohibiting it, I should say.
Well, unfortunately, the bottom line with natural gas is it's not a renewable form of energy. And as we've discussed in previous segments, that's really where our focus should be. But, you know, it's not going to happen overnight.
That's right. Let's put that on the table, because you bring up the big elephant in the room issue, that it is not a renewable. I view it, and my word for it, is it's a transitional fuel. I don't know whether that transition is 30 years or, as some say, up to 100 years in Obama's speech from last January or whenever it was. But let's say it's somewhere between 30 and 100 years of apparent availability of fairly cheap and available natural gas through fracking. That transition at least gives us an environmental benefit. It's not a cure, but it's an environmental benefit that it allows coal to be displaced and oil to be displaced to some degree, and as a result, less carbon emissions to help the global warming debate. Just to put that figure on the table, because we haven't tabled it today, roughly 60% of carbon is emitted compared to burning oil or gasoline in any of its other forms. So we have a 60% advantage, and the more coal you displace, the lesser is the environmental impact. It sure isn't zero, it would be in a renewable time zone, but it's at least a step in the right direction, and that's why I believe it's a good thing to foster the natural gas industry with tight regulation on its production problems. I think there was a professor at Cornell University, June and Luis, who recently put out a study that said that one of the problems not being looked at is leakage along the whole chain of events, because, as we know, it's not just carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide that are bad greenhouse gases. In fact, methane, CH4, which is natural gas, is much worse, global warming. So if we don't have a real tight production-to-use train of events, then we're buying ourselves more of a problem. And he's got a good point. I think his study, I read it months ago, was 8%. I don't agree with his figure, and certainly the industry doesn't. But even a couple of percent of leakage along that value chain makes one wonder about the benefits from a climate point of view given that you believe in the climate issue. Anyway, that's I just wanted to bring up that point, that leakage is something that the whole industry has to watch for, and the regulators, of course, have to watch for.
I think you hit the nail on the head with that, that it all boils down to the regulation, and the protection of the environment should be paramount. You know, it's been very interesting talking to you today and discussing some very interesting components to this very heated topic, especially with Luis's perspective. So, Tom, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today. It always is a pleasure talking to you and learning from you.
Well, it was my pleasure again, June. There's, like we started out saying, Luis, so much to talk about, but I think we've covered the main aspects of it, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me again.
Thank you, June. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Luis. And, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer and Luis Mejia on the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.